This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, President Clinton takes bold steps to combat air pollution, and if he can pull it off, our climate and our health will benefit. New ways to save land and lend money keep towns alive and cut back development on the urban fringe. A portrait of the Colorado River at the end of a long journey. And in the Earth calendar, bats in Oklahoma are eating 20,000 pounds of insects each night. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. President Clinton has put in motion steps that could have a greater effect on the environment than anything else he has done in his term of office. If he's able to achieve his objectives for reducing air pollution, climate change would be stemmed, and the health of all Americans would be improved. In his speech before the United Nations Earth Summit in New York, the president answered environmental and European critics who have been unhappy about the failure of the United States to specify targets and timetables to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which cause global warming. He plans to set up a process which will culminate in a White House conference to be held in October. After everyone has been heard from, the administration will spell out specific emissions reduction targets for inclusion in an enforceable binding agreement to be negotiated at the World Climate Change Conference scheduled for Kyoto, Japan in December. Katie McGinney, the chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, spoke to us from the White House.
The president and vice president both feel very strongly that climate change is perhaps one of the largest, if not the largest, environmental challenge we face, something that poses not only environmental threats, but also economic threats, threats to national security. When we see, for example, the kind of dramatic storm systems that we've witnessed in all parts of our country over the last several years and decade, that means huge economic loss, huge human loss, as we've seen the tragedy of deaths across the country from these storm systems. And as climate change sets in around the world, particularly as it hits less stable countries, it could lead to global instability. So the president, vice president feel strongly climate change is an issue demanding of our utmost concern and attention.
The United States took a bit of a beating at Denver because we didn't go along with some specific levels of reduction that the Germans and others were advocating. How do we work our way through that one?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the president very much welcomes the obvious attention and concern that European leaders and other leaders around the world are showing on this issue, and he certainly joins them in that statement of concern. When it comes to setting specific targets and timetables, we are committed to doing that. We look to Kyoto in December as the place where we hope the whole world can come together around legally binding targets and timetables that provide a flexible implementation network and that call on the developing countries to join us in this effort. So the president is very appreciative of that and will work to ensure that at Kyoto we can reach that kind of agreement. However, we need to make sure if we're serious about this issue that the numbers we are articulating are real numbers and that they are real numbers that are capable of being achieved. And it was a little disturbing to us that as some countries put numbers on the table, the European Union's own energy ministry, for example, was on the same day reporting that energy-related carbon dioxide emissions will actually increase 8% by the year 2010. The president wants seriousness of speech and intention on this issue, not just strong words, but actions that will reduce emissions. And that means before we put numbers on the table, we are going to make sure that we have brought people in, that we understand what technological opportunities we have, for example, and that we have a clear path for achieving those reductions.
And so will we go to Kyoto with some numbers in mind?
It's absolutely our intention to do that.
McGinty says the president will personally chair a White House conference on the issue in the early fall. In anticipation of the last negotiating session before Kyoto, the administration will hear from industry, environmentalists, and Congress. It will then call for an enforceable agreement with targets and timetables. On the domestic front, the president sided with EPA Administrator Carol Browner and endorsed EPA's proposed tightening of air pollution standards with respect to ground-level ozone and small particulates. Again, Katie McGinty.
Well, the president really delved into this issue, reviewed the record, looked at the science, and felt very strongly that literally after 20 years of not updating these standards, that it really was high time that we took important additional steps to protect the health of the American people. He was very much, he found very compelling the science, which clearly indicates that incidences of childhood asthma, for example, are very much on the increase. He also found very compelling that the science clearly states that small particles, these little particulate matter, that those small particles lodge deep within our lungs and actually cause premature death. It was on the basis of that that the president said, I want to move forward here. I want to put strong protections in place. But you know, Peter, that the president has always had a tremendous amount of insight when it comes to the environment in terms of saying we can and we will find ways to have environmental protection and economic growth be mutually reinforcing. And so the president also directed that the agency undertake a very good implementation plan that will have us working in partnership with state and local governments, with industry leaders, in order that we can work and build from the very important progress that has already been made to date in cleaning up our air.
McGinty says the president has directed EPA to work on an implementation plan under which cities with programs to achieve existing standards would continue, and no further action would be required until current goals have been achieved. She also is hopeful that a voluntary program for air quality improvement endorsed by 37 governors will bring most areas into compliance with the new standards. As a start, the EPA says it will focus on emissions from utility plants, and the timetables will give counties up to the year 2004 for achieving ozone pollution controls. Also, EPA will allow 5 years to build a monitoring network for fine particulates. Only after that will plans for meeting the new standards be required. Some members of Congress, with urging from industry lobbyists, say they will attempt to overrule the tighter regulations. But the administration has a strong political argument, as it will suggest that Congress people who vote against the tighter air regulations are voting against sick old people and against kids with asthma. Blighted and abandoned neighborhoods are all too common in American cities. Each area's downfall surely has a lengthy list of causes, but most share common problems with attracting investment and absentee landlords. In response, community loan funds and community land trusts have emerged as a major force in some cities. They provide loans and maintain properties which otherwise might fall into disrepair. Their success keeps the environment of cities alive and reduces pressure for development at the urban fringe. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally visited a land trust and loan fund in upstate New York and has this report.
The Hamilton Hill section of Schenectady, New York has seen better days. This part of the neighborhood was built when the General Electric Corporation was adding jobs in the 1930s. But since then, GE's cut back its workforce and the neighborhood's deteriorated. And as the area got worse, few banks were willing to risk lending their money. Meanwhile, many homeowners moved to other neighborhoods with more stable property values. Then a few years ago, a community land trust was formed, and financing became available through a community loan fund, bringing capital and energy into the neighborhood.
The key to the community land trust is that it retains the land and keeps it in trust for the community, and only sells the house. But what it does is create a partnership between the homeowner, the organization, which is made up of residents from the neighborhood as well as outside people. But the neighborhood residents are the ones who have the most control of the organization and determine what happens in situations. And the partnership that's then created between the homeowner, the organization, and the community helps to not just stabilize, a particular house, a particular piece of property, but the neighborhood in general.
Beverly Burnett is the executive director of Hill and Vale Affordable Housing. We stand in front of a property owned by Hill and Vale on a block that's long been in decline. Burnett says, think of your own neighborhood and how important local ownership is in keeping the community going. Burnett says when absentee landlords own properties, residents don't often have a sense of stewardship.
You look around and you can see the results of that in, boarded up vacant houses with broken windows. And this neighborhood has, because of the absentee landlords, this neighborhood has become a place where people on social services tend to live. Because of the rents and the absentee landlords will take Section 8, and there's certain codes that they have to meet, but they if they can get away with not putting any money into the house, they will. And I also believe that property values have dropped so much, it ends up being more beneficial for them to collect rent until the city comes and condemns the house and boards it up, and then the city takes it back in taxes and the person walks away, from the house.
Similar situations exist all across the country. In many cases, the only time public and private money arrives is when the neighborhood is gentrified, and by then, the low-income residents can no longer afford to remain. In Schenectady, gentrification is not a problem today. In fact, a little gentrification might be greatly appreciated. But Burnett says land trusts can work in gentrifying neighborhoods as well as those in decline.
A problem we face in redoing houses is they cost more to redo than what you can sell them for, what they can appraise for. But we've seen on a particular street that we've targeted, now we own five houses on, you can see that the street, from 2 years ago, has actually begun to stable out. And it's more homeowner occupied on that street. And as the community land trust grows in the neighborhood, it will, again, help stabilize the community in terms of getting people who are homeowners into the house. It's not 100% true, but people tend to take better care of their house if they own it than if they're renting it.
The spiral of decline for a neighborhood often includes the loss of interest from mainstream corporations. Banks and insurance companies pull out, and businesses lose a base of customers. The practice of intentionally avoiding a neighborhood by banks and insurance companies is called redlining, and it's illegal. But community land trusts and loan funds work on the front lines and can act as magnets to bring diversified investment back into neighborhoods. Bob Radliff manages the Capital District Community Loan Fund in Albany, New York.
The red line that used to prohibit or prevent institutions such as banks from making investments in communities like this indeed helped establish and facilitate and force groups like community loan funds to evolve and be created. We kind of draw a red line around a community like this and say that's where we want to invest our money. More traditional lenders are kind of following groups like this lead, and they're kind of coming further and further towards what needs to be done to make loans to lower-income people so that groups like Hill and Vale can then start working with even lower-income people. So they're kind of pulling the free market system along with them to show that it can work and that they shouldn't be so afraid of making these kind of loans.
Radlett's organization has lent $3 million to about 90 groups and businesses. They've also leveraged about $20 million worth of loans. Compared to banks, that's not a lot of money, but most of their loans are meant to be small and are responsible for getting places like a car repair shop, a print shop, and many nonprofit organizations off the ground. And once they're up and running, it's easier to attract loans, insurance policies, and business. Each success for the Community Loan Fund means new life for troubled neighborhoods, and that keeps businesses and families in the city, increasing the quality of life, and reducing the need for more development in the suburbs.
But I think a goal of Hill and Vale Affordable Housing is to make the urban core more attractive so that more people will want to come and live here and use the existing infrastructure and therefore have less impact on the surrounding area. So I certainly think that's a primary goal of many inner city community development organizations.
Community loan funds and land trusts have increased dramatically in recent years. They and other organizations with different objectives but similar philosophies are now present in nearly every city in the U.S. You can get involved by either investing in them or donating your time. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind. Send us your questions and tell us what you think about the environment. You can visit us anytime on the internet where you can hear the Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Colin Fletcher is the author of River, One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to the Sea. At age 67, Fletcher traveled alone and encountered moments ranging from hilarity to quiet reflection. He presents a portrait of the end of the river just before it reaches the Gulf of California in Mexico.
Near the end of my journey, down in the Delta in Mexico, after the river had been bled dry by irrigation ditches, then had regained sluggish, reed-fringed life, it funneled through a primitive Indian fish weir into a different world. This new world was all water and mud and light. The water raced down a narrow channel. The mud spread wide on both sides of it. The light filled them both, filled everything. I floated down into this shimmering new world. At first the channel was so narrow that I barely had room to get both oars in the water at once. So narrow that I thought, can this really be the mighty Colorado flowing out to sea? But before long the current slowed and the channel widened, and I could halfway ignore navigation and just drift on down and examine this new world that surrounded me. The mudflats lay a few inches below my eye level, and I could look out across their gloriously smooth and gleaming surfaces that stretched back 40 or 50 yards to wedges of thick tamarisk. When I looked ahead down the sparkling channel, I could see a line of distant desert mountains. Nearby detail began to register. At water's edge, a sloping mudflat gleamed green. I pulled alongside. Algae. Green seminal algae. I drifted on down. Ahead, one great blue heron chased another away from the river. From where I sat watching them long-legged out across the radiant mud in competing yet conjugal tandem, they looked elegant, symbolic. And as I drifted on down, sitting enthroned in my bulging blue raft enclave at the moving center of this bright new world, I found myself marveling at the persistence and pugnacity and labyrinthine pulsations of the phenomenon we call life, our anti-entropic blip within an entropic world. found myself marveling at the way its early and simple forms are always waiting, given a sliver of a chance, to grab new footholds by creating, apparently from nothing but water and mud and light in such unpromising and seemingly hostile places as primeval ooze, green patches of basic life stuff that encompass within themselves the seeds of much more complex life forms. Found myself marveling at the way the descendants of such basic stuff, down one bloodline, may at that same moment of apparent creation be defending their temporary territories on those same mudflats. Marveling at the way another descendant, down another bloodline that has drifted toward at least a modicum of self-awareness, may by chance be floating past at that moment in a bulging blue enclave on the last lap of a long and unnecessary and maybe crazy journey, and be made aware, under the influence of the same water and mud and light and the presence of the two fellow life forms, that his journey had just vaulted into one of those rare but soaring intervals that can, thank God, illuminate for the long blink of a magical eye almost any journey, any life.
Colin Fletcher, reading from his book, River, One Man's Journey Down the Colorado River, Source to Sea, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Every year at this time, plumes of bats come streaming out of certain caves at sunset. In northwestern Oklahoma, the cave on the Selmans property is home to over a million bats. 10 times a year, the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation brings people out there to see the spectacle. Jeremy Garrett is with that department, and he explains that bats live in the cave for only about 6 months a year.
In Oklahoma, Mexican free-tailed bats return sometime in May, early June, and the females have their pups in June, and then the pups begin flying about mid-July or so, and then the whole colony sort of disperses around September.
For some, bats have a bad reputation. Storytellers say they suck your blood or purposefully get tangled in long hair. But Garrett says bats do neither of those things. Instead, they perform important services, like eating up insects that would otherwise pester people or devour crops.
Basically, most populations of bats are insectivores, which means they eat all sorts of insects. And since bats are active primarily at nighttime, they capture night-flying insects. They've done some studies to test how many insects a bat eats, and depending on where you are in the U.S., they eat different prey species, obviously. Some bats have been recorded to eat about 600 mosquitoes in an hour and about 2,000 mosquitoes in an evening. The bats at Selman Bat Cave, we estimate to eat about 10 tons of insects nightly.
Bats can be so prolific because they're skilled hunters and flyers. Garrett says if you watch them carefully, you can see bats performing high-flying aerial acrobatics.
The bats will capture the insect with, you know, either a wing or with their foot, and then they'll have to, you know, kind of chunk it in their mouth real quick. And so that kind of makes for an interesting sight because, you know, while they're not able to use both wings, they start falling, and then they have to toss the insect in real quick, and then they have to kind of catch up with their wings and start flying again.
Bats need these flying skills not only to catch prey, but also so they can navigate while emerging from the cave. Garrett says the bats first begin venturing out of the Selman Cave in the early evening and continue coming out for about 2 hours.
The bats just kind of start trickling out, you know, one by one, and then it kind of becomes, you know, just a little more steady flow, you know, hundreds coming out at a time, and all of a sudden it's just like floodgates burst open and bats just start swooping out in just a big spiral.
The latest Batman movie is playing to packed houses. Not one of them has shown any ability in either catching bugs, much less eating them. Why not require the lead in the next Batman movie to show he can catch and eat a few pounds to show he's worthy of the role? Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Some counties send their garbage to landfills. One county has a better idea. They figured out how to put the junk back in your living room and have you pay for it as well. We talk green, about environmentally friendly houses. You may need one to store your junk. And while some people restore stuff and other people recycle it, Craig Nuttycombe sings about it, showing that even our consumptive ways can inspire song. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Not too long ago, garbage was pretty simple. You threw something away and it was dumped in the landfill. But in many places, environmental concerns have made landfilling garbage or solid waste expensive. The need to cut back on waste has led to extensive recycling programs, and now a new strategy is taking hold across the country where things like furniture and building supplies once sent to the landfill are cleaned up, sold, and reused. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally reports from the community warehouse in Hoosick, New York.
Rensselaer County, in between the Massachusetts border and the Hudson River in upstate New York, sends its garbage to a dump more than 150 miles away. All their dumps have been closed, and no one wants a new one near them. But sending that trash that far away costs a lot of money and doesn't make much environmental sense, especially when there are alternatives.
We did waste characterizations in our solid waste authority, and we found all this really good stuff being dumped at the landfills and said, this is too good to throw away. So we said, okay, how can we collect it? How can we get it back out to people who need it or want it? And so we came up with this idea of a community warehouse. It's a combination waste reduction and reuse project as well as an economic development project.
Meg Morris is the manager of the community warehouse in Hoosick Falls, New York, a project of the Eastern Rensselaer County Solid Waste Management Authority. It's just a store and a few barns where unwanted but usable stuff like couches, office furniture, doors, stoves, and you name it, is cleaned up and sold. It keeps the stuff out of the landfills and puts it back into use.
What happened was once people knew we existed, instead of just taking stuff and throwing it into their dumpsters, they would actually call us and say, Meg, we're cleaning out an office. Do you want this stuff? And so we'd jump in the truck and run over and say, okay, we'll take this, this, this. So we were able to, they saved money because they didn't have a disposal cost. We got material for our project, and so it was a win-win situation for everybody. And then, of course, our purchasers purchase it, and that keeps our employees paid and pays the rent and everything else.
This sort of reuse, as it's called in environmental circles, is nothing new. Hand-me-downs, yard sales, Salvation Army, and junkyards remain the basis for reuse in this country. Every year, for instance, in San Francisco, the city brings around trucks to pick up large items like unwanted couches and tables. It's become almost a festival of reuse, where people walk around taking what they need, and by the time the trucks roll around, only the truly unusable stuff is left. The community warehouse adds to this mix, but with the specific purpose of keeping things out of the landfill. Vivian Smith is an enthusiastic community warehouse customer. She says her family reused everything. Doing otherwise was unthinkable.
We emptied out a house, and I brought most of it over here. Windows, doors, bathtub, toilet, sink. Everything that could be reused that we didn't want. Because it has some real good things here. In fact, there's a headboard over there right now that I'd like, but it's got a postcard on it, so I'll have to wait.
The postcard is for customers who want something specific. Their postcard is kept on file till the item comes in. Then it's mailed out, and the customer has a week or two to come pick it up. Other customers like to just roam the aisles looking for bargains. The office furniture, perhaps the most plentiful items at the warehouse, are at the front of the store, and household items are towards the back.
We have, as we go back a little further, we get into, we have a lot of home furnishings, dressers, couches, chairs, bed frames. We have a lot of young couples who come in who are just furnishing a new home or a new apartment. We have people on fixed incomes who come in who just, you know, their couch finally died and they need something a little bit better. It really runs the gamut of who our customer base is here. And it does, too. It goes from the low-income family way up to big businesses have been in here purchasing things.
Off the main store is another space filled with stuff you might find in a home garage. Skis, paint, chandeliers, and exercise equipment. Meg Morris says they tend to accumulate things until word gets out that good deals are available.
Wow. What are these things?
Paper towel holders. This is our little corner for multiples. There for a while, this corner was occupied by mailboxes. And we had quite a few mailboxes. But it was funny, they must be a landlord's association or something. Once one guy came in and bought about five of them for his apartment houses, the next thing we knew, they kept going out in multiples of 5 and 10 instead of just, you know, like one at a time. So now we're into paper towel holders. And we're just waiting for there to be a run on paper towel holders, and then we'll be all set.
The concept for the community warehouse comes from a place called Urban Ore, the granddaddy of all reuse operations. Located in Berkeley, California, Urban Ore has become the place to go for anything and everything. It's become a local institution. And Meg Morris says she hopes the community warehouse will follow in Urban Ore's success. The key, says Morris, is the warehouse's diversity of products. Builders in the area know they can find things like sinks or doors or even woodworking there. And if something isn't 100% perfect, they'll take what is usable and throw the rest away.
If something comes in and it's broken, we'll take its components apart. For instance, you're looking at a box full of doorknobs. On occasion, we will have doors that come in that either in transit or whenever just get split or whatever, and we can't sell them. So we take off all the hinges, we take off all the doorknobs, and these sell as well as the doors themselves. We have through this corridor here is just filled with windows and doors.
The community warehouse opened in the spring of 1995. A grant from the state provided the funds, but Morris says they're almost breaking even and expects they'll be self-sufficient soon. But she adds the warehouse has benefits not accounted for in their operating cost.
We had a project year where we had to keep tabs on everything, and that project year we saved, what they would work out, 252,000 pounds of material from going to the landfill. We generated an income of about $100,000. Our expenses were a little higher than that, but nonetheless, our income, that was very good for our first year.
Meg Morris is the director of the community warehouse in Hoosick Falls, New York. She says Americans need to keep the reuse ethic alive. At one time, it was done for economic reasons or just because of principle. But today, environmental concerns have added one more reason to reuse. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about affordable green housing and housing design. What is a greenhouse? Do you have to be rich to afford one? We'd like to have you give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and our email address is green@wamc.org. Two guests are with me. One is George James. He's program manager for the Department of Energy Building America program in Washington, D.C., and he works with the building industry to bring about energy-efficient and environmentally sensitive, affordable, and adaptable housing. Also with me is Plenty Fisk, an architect and co-director of the nonprofit Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems in Austin, Texas. And Mr. Fisk has trademarked a project known as Greenforms and is a participant in the DOE Building America program. George James, let me start with you.
All right.
What is a green home? How does somebody know one when one sees it?
Well, I think this is an evolutionary process. Probably right now we're at the stage where the seed has just popped out of the ground, and we hope it'll grow into a real tree. What we are trying to do, of course, is reduce energy usage within the country, energy generation. So in a lot of ways, our whole problem with the greenhouse gases and so on results in the fact that we are generating a lot of electricity, a lot of the power, by means which put carbon dioxide and other elements into the atmosphere.
So we want to build more energy-efficient homes.
That's right.
And this is an idea that's been around for some time. But
it's been around for some time. Just in the last few years, have we been able to demonstrate to builders, or have them participate in programs where actually building an environmentally sensitive, energy-efficient house can cost them less money than the way they were doing things before.
And Plenty Fisk from the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems, is this an idea, the green home, something that architects and builders are now getting their heads around? What's going on out there?
Well, it depends on where you are. In Austin, Texas, we have about one-fifth of the total starts in housing connected directly to the Green Builder Program, which our organization started years ago back in 91 and 92. And there are mainstream builders that now belong to that program. And essentially, in Austin, it has become, in essence, a marketing tool. And if you're not building green, you don't sell very well.
Well, let me just stop you for a moment. How does the potential home purchaser, or someone's getting a home built for them, know whether it's green or not green? What are the criteria that you want the homeowner to be looking at to decide what to do?
Well, there's some fairly straightforward ones. George hit one of them, and that is, what do you expect to pay in your energy bills? But, of course, a lot of these things depend on where you are geographically in the country. Where we are in Texas, things like water issues and where you're getting your materials from. We don't have a lot of lumber sitting next to us. Any number of things like that come into the issue. And also how people feel about the building once it's finished. Things like indoor air quality, quality of water, quality of any number of things in the building over the long term become very important to people.
Okay. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Let's go to the phones. And Matt in California, you're Talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for having me. Global Green USA is trying to create efforts that bring green building to a really tangible, practical level.
So you're with Global Green, and how are you going about doing that?
Well, we're trying to work in partnership with the Department of Energy and groups like Habitat for Humanity and the Los Angeles Housing Authority to make green building accessible by making it affordable.
And how do you do that? I guess most people think that all this fancy technology and so on is out of the price range of the normal home buyer.
Right, and that's been the challenge. I think we've recognized that green building has been something that affluent home builders in West Los Angeles and other parts of affluent communities, and commercial builders who have the ability to take the risks. In some cases, there's been isolated examples, unfortunately isolated, of people building green affordable housing, but it's generally not been accessible. So we need to demonstrate the life cycle cost benefits versus the first costs, showing how they benefit the community at large. There are some intangibles, and those are the hard things to get at, but so we're trying to demonstrate the real tangible benefits to low-income families.
So, George James, does DOE help this process? How do you explain
this to
folks in Watts who are worried about simply scraping enough together to put a roof over their head?
This is the really critical item. People who are buying their first home, in many cases, aren't the wealthiest people on earth, and yet we want to be sure they're buying a green home, a very energy-efficient home. So we're working with Habitat and groups such as Matt to take some of these technologies and apply them to entry-level housing. This summer, we will be building two houses with Habitat for Humanity using these advanced wall materials called stress skin panels, because by putting up a whole wall in one segment, it should be much easier for the Habitat volunteers.
Okay. Well, Matt, thanks for your call. And let's go and be joined by Donald now in Connecticut. Donald, my understanding is that the Ecology House is one of your projects?
Yes, it is.
And how do you deal with some of these new materials that we've been hearing about?
Well, to explain first, the Ecology House is a stock plan of a house developed first approximately 10 years ago for the New Alchemy Institute in Cape Cod. And it was their project to develop a house plan that would be adaptable to many climates, mainly northern climates, and represent the state-of-art practices in both energy and environmental design. So that plan is developed and is available as what's called a basic plan.
Does that mean that somebody can go out and buy one or buy the plans to have one built?
Those plans are essentially available and being built throughout North America.
And Plenty Fisk from the Center of Maximum Potential Building Systems. Have you looked at the Ecology House program? How does it look to you?
Well, I think, you know, we're as George said, in a mode of the seed being planted, so all of us have a slightly different way of trying to handle this stuff. In our case, we're very connected to what's called open building or a grow home or adaptable home way of operating, where the materials and subsystems fit what we were talking about related to the Austin Green Builder Program, but that the building itself, since there is an immense amount of waste and so on regarding how the building is used over time and how it changes, that we're trying to develop a way that the building can flex over time to the user needs. And as you might guess, if you look at the dynamics of a family, and this dynamic is increasing every day, that really a building that could really relate to people and their various use styles.
So when you have more kids, you tack on another room.
It could last longer, and it could make more sense related to how you use materials.
Now, here's the tough question. When the kids go away, do you take the extra room off?
Well, it depends. I mean, we went through this with
then maybe the adults have adopted some new spare time activities, and that room would fit in perfectly.
Well, it might have become the home office. It might have become, your son all of a sudden came back from college unexpectedly. Who knows?
A good question, Peter, and everyone should ask it whenever we drive a car or flush a toilet or build a house, is what is the environmental impact of what I'm doing? And if we dreamed a bit and said, can I build a house that has zero negative impact and, in fact, positive environmental impact, how would I go about it? And I think Pliny in Texas and many of these houses throughout the country show that you can be energy independent, that is, solar and photovoltaic supplied heating and electricity. And, in fact, with whether it's a greenhouse or other things you do in the landscape, benefit the local environment. So I'd do some dreaming and then some searching. There are certainly some examples in Tennessee that are good examples.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. And let's hear from Nadav in Vermont. Nadav, welcome back to the Environment Show. You've been with us before.
Thank you very much.
Green housing. What are you folks doing with respect to this issue?
Well, we publish Environmental Building News, the national newsletter on environmentally responsible design and construction. So our role is really to try to follow what all these great folks you're speaking with are doing in different parts of the country and provide the networking, let people know about what each other are doing. And we also do some of our own work researching some of the new materials and systems that are coming along.
Let me ask you something about that, because, again, another email question, this one from Nashua, New Hampshire, from Marion. She says, when we work on remodeling projects in our home, the local lumberyards don't carry much in the way of green building materials and products. How can the homeowner find recycled materials and the new green products for home improvement? Do you have any advice for someone facing that issue?
We certainly do, and that's exactly one of the roles that our newsletter tries to fill, is providing information on these new and different products. There's quite a number of resource directories, product listings that different groups have put out, and we review these and let you know which ones are the best, the most reliable, which they have different specialties. Some tend to focus more on healthy products for good indoor air quality. Others might focus more on the recycled content products or the energy efficiency products.
So, Nadav, if someone wants to subscribe to the Environmental Building News, how do they do that?
They can call us in Brattleboro, Vermont at 802-257-7300.
And this is a publication that works for the homeowner as well as the contractor? And
we're more focused towards the contractor and the professional, the homeowners that are interested should see that their architect or their builder reads Environmental Building News and has the most current information.
Plenty, let me ask you something that relates to the contractor issue. If someone decides that they are going to build an environmentally sound home, every contractor, I'm sure, will say, sure, I believe in that stuff. How do you make a decision?
Well, we have several criteria. One is their experience in the area and what they're talking about doing and trying to visit projects that they claim are such. Depending on your context, and again, the city of Austin, we publish a sort of resource guide of responsible builders and contractors that do these kind of things that have been certified by the city in one way or another to do this kind of thing. So we are a relatively sophisticated place in the country, but hopefully that is not an impossible thing to do for other cities that develop green builder programs.
I think what Pliny says is quite right. Some areas are much more sophisticated. They do have systems whereby the contractors can be rated, but I think his other suggestion that in your area people can just check around with other work that particular contractor has done and talk to the people that are living in the house, how well they feel the house is operating. Because it is a learning curve. One of the things that we hope to do in the Department of Energy and working with HUD and EPA are training programs or assisting some of the training organizations to put on programs to help contractors do the proper kind of thing. I mean, there's very few of these people that want to do a bad job. In many cases, they don't know what the proper job would be, and this is where I think we can do a lot of help.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up. Nadav, I want to thank you for the call.
I'd like one more question, point, Peter. People could call our information system. We have an online information system, and if I can give that phone number.
Please do.
That's 1-800-363-3732. It's our ERIC service, and a call to them, since it's a free call, we'll be able to get them information, or they can certainly, if they have questions that they'd like the Department of Energy to answer for them, ERIC, if they can't answer them, we'll get back to us or
okay.
Get back to Pliny or something.
That's 1-800-363-3732, and that's the Department of Energy information line on
yes.
The green building.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you both. We have been talking green about green housing. And my guests have been George James from the Department of Energy and Pliny Fisk, an architect with the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems. We've been talking green about green housing, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Let's hear from you next time. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. The basis of many of our environmental problems can be directly linked to our insatiable desire for stuff. Homes are getting bigger and so require more land and more stuff to put in them. And as you heard earlier, we're sending perfectly good things to the dump. Craig Nuttycombe is a singer-songwriter from Pacific Grove, California. His song, Stuff, appears on his new CD, Planetorial Janitor.
There's a hole in the soul of most of the human race, a hole in our psyche nobody wants to face. So far removed from our home, the earth, we only know how to measure our worth, spending our time standing in line to buy stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. Power of advertising would have you believe. If you just buy this or that, you'll have all that you need. Yet for all this bought and for all this sold, there's an emptiness inside our soul, and we try to fill it up with all of our stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. Quality is a thing of the past. Very few build anything that will last. Hey, go out and buy it new today. Use it once or twice and throw it away. And the landfills fill up with all of our stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. And the world is an internet. We interact with the screen, isolate to communicate as we live out our techno-addictive dreams. I asked someone, would you like to walk with me? Maybe go up a hill and just sit under a tree. They say, no, come on with me and we'll have a ball. Spend the day down at the mall and we'll all load up an overabundance of stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. Consumerism is a disease of the 20th century. Keep it alive the way that we thrive on stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. There's a hole in the soul, most of the human race. A hole in our psyche nobody wants to face. From the crap we create to keep us amused with the nuclear energy that we use, all adds up to a deadly abuse of stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. Non-renewable, non-reusable stuff. 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 Stuff.
Singer-songwriter Craig Nuttycombe from his new CD, Planetorial Janitor. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 392. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.